Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 29th of May. Very nice to have you with us. 14 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we thank you for being here. We thank you for joining us and keeping us company as we keep you company on this Wednesday morning. We are in the midst of three terrific panelists. I will introduce them momentarily. And we also have a lot to discuss, many cool things and not so cool things to talk about in the docket this morning. First, I want to remind you that the music you just heard, or to tell you, I guess I can't remind you if you never knew, Gary Clark Jr. is playing the Palace in Albany, New York this Saturday. That's June 1 at the Palace, again, the Palace in Albany. But you can find out more at palacealbany.org, and Gary Clark Jr. will be playing the music, providing our bumper music into our segments.
Should we know Gary Clark Sr.?
I don't.
Okay. Just wondering if his dad was.
Yeah,
know.
I don't. I don't know.
Or maybe his mom.
I don't know.
Okay,
I can find out.
Yeah. Just curious.
Also, I want to remind you that the lockbox is open and underway. We are very close to the start of our on-air fund drive, which is June 10th. What is important to realize is that there's a lot of stuff going around and going on, and we want to bring that all to you. And so to do and to ensure that, we want to make sure that we have the shortest on-air fund drive that we possibly can. The way to ensure that is to put as much money as you can into the lockbox and to fill the lockbox. If you know you're going to give us $20 or $50 or $1,000, then you can do it now, and then all of that money counts for the first day of the fund drive, and that's money that we don't have to make later. This has proved to be very successful and helpful in keeping our drives rather short. I will tell you two, maybe three disappointing things. One, we know typically our June drive is the longest because people are out, school is ending, people are vacationing, things are starting. People are on the move, so it is. That is one thing. So we want to try to get you before you go off and do all your summer stuff. That's one. Two is we need $1.2 million. We raised our goal last fall. We made it easily, not easily, but not with we did it in a matter of 4 or 5 days. Nothing about that is easy. I don't want to
no,
give that
I was
impression.
Say, morning tonight asking
yes,
is not
no,
easy. No,
no. But we want to replicate that as close as we can or beat it would be fantastic. So that's a thing. And oh, by the way, public media generally is having a really hard time, and we want to make sure that we can overcome some of those concerns as well. So underwriting is down. We need help. We're okay. You're seeing a lot of stations. We just heard about GBH in Boston laying off a number of people. And this has been happening to radio stations to our north, south, east, and west, as well as network-wide over the past 6 months. And we are okay right now, but we want to keep it that way and make sure that the shows that you like and respect and love will be around for you in the future. So all of that to say, you can help out in the lockbox, WAMC.org, WAMC.org. If you hear us talk and you put it off, that's okay. But if you see an email coming through, an email blast or something on social media, or hear a promo about us talking about it, it's really important. And if you can help us out, we would greatly appreciate it. Again, it's WAMC.org. Just go to the Donate Now button. All of the cool stuff, the premiums, those are all there. You can go to the drop-down menu and check out if you want a ball cap or a mug or a rocks glass or whatever the case may be. The stuff is there, and you can take advantage of that as well. So, panel at WAMC to write to us, WAMC.org. to help out in the lockbox, and we would love to hear from you. All right. Now, let's go to what is the reason you're listening for, and that is for our panel. And I want to introduce our terrific panel to you and begin with Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarias-Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing pretty well. Enjoying a little cooler weather now.
Good. Are you off for the summer?
So I'm done teaching, except for, you know, a couple of stragglers that need to finish up some credits. But so I'm just working on, you know, I'm working on a couple of publications, actually, this summer.
I made a joke. Yeah. I think, I don't know, it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. I said there was a lot of graduation activity, and I saw about 200 photos of graduations on my Facebook feed, and Vera was in about 100 of them.
Well, not that many, but I had this year an incredible group that graduated.
You were.
And five of them are going on to PhD programs in various areas. So that was a really great success. And I've known them for many years, and it's just been lovely.
Well, it was very endearing, I have to say, because first of all, everyone looks so happy. Second of all, you seem like the best professor in the world. Sorry, Libby and Jim,
you're the
best too, but just the fact that their love and affection for you, and vice versa, and I just thought it was very heartwarming and really sweet. So congratulations! It was nice to see you in all those photos. It was it was funny because I was like, oh, there's Vera again. Well, there she is. Look at her smile. Libby Post is with us. She's a political consultant, and a lobbyist, and our dear friend. She would normally be with us on Mondays. We didn't have a show on Monday. We said, hey, can you do another day? Here she is. Good morning.
Here I am.
How are you?
Good morning. I'm okay.
And I just want you to say just where her mind is right now. She walked in, she goes, oh, gee, I shouldn't have done this.
It's true.
I've got buyer's remorse.
I'm really
busy today.
Yeah, you know what? I can't say why.
You have an event that you have to get ready for,
right, and at the house this evening, and we need to get ready for that. And I've got a lot to do with work, and campaigns are in full swing. We have a little less than a month until primary day, and so everyone's ramping up.
Well, I wish you well on that, but
well,
I thank
so
you
much
for being here. Very, very nice. Jim Ketterer joins us as well, senior fellow at Bard College. Bard Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College. Hello, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning, Joe. I just want to mention one thing about the lockbox and the fund drive. I've lived in countries where the media is heavily controlled, where access to information is extremely difficult, and I'm sure the listeners know this, but I just want to emphasize it. Number one, we shouldn't take it for granted, and number two, when it goes away, it's almost impossible to bring back, and so do what you can, do what needs to be done, and please don't take it for granted.
You know, that's such a great point, Jim, and I thank you for bringing it up. We talk a lot during the fund drives about the fragility of public media, and we're seeing that now. And there's an on switch, but there's also an off switch, and you can't imagine it going off until it goes off. But getting it to go back on again is really hard, and obviously money plays into it, and who can take over that signal, and all of that stuff. And if it's not supported, and it's not, and the powers that be are conspiring against you, it's very difficult to make the case that this is something that we need to keep alive. And I will say that we're certainly in better shape than other stations in the world. However, I don't know, as for you, you know, of being in other countries and seeing this, of what that is, when you don't have a media source that you rely on to get the information that you need to really survive.
Yeah, I mean, what ends up filling the vacuum is often conspiracy theories or the propaganda that is coming from the powers that be. And what often happens in the erosion of freedom of the press is that it doesn't happen like an off switch. It happens bit by bit by bit until you don't realize that it's happening until suddenly it's gone. And it is fragile, but it's so important. And I know I'm stating the obvious and I'm probably preaching to the choir, but I still think it needs to be said in these times.
And we have a great example of this exactly happening right now in the country of Georgia. I have a former student who's a Fulbright there, and they have had nothing, you know, like staged major protests against this sort of what they call the Russian law, which just has been accepted and is being pushed through in terms of curtailing international media, especially foreign-owned, if there is a foreign-owned member ship in this media outlet. And my former student is reporting that civil rights groups and NGOs are being curtailed as well as part of that law. So this is a very scary development, and we should watch these kinds of events internationally, because if we don't watch out, this can also happen here.
Well, if Trump is elected, it will happen here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I you know, I say this is not a very funny joke, but it could happen in the state of Georgia.
Yeah. Yes, that's, I was, that's why I carefully said the country of Georgia, because I didn't want people to misunderstand. But
where are we? So as well as other places. Mm-hmm. Well, it's WAMC.org to help. We'll talk more about this as we go through the morning, but WAMC.org. And we thank you very much for everything you're doing and everything you have done and everything you will do in the future. We love you and we thank you. And we will now get on with the show and talk about the stuff that is going on and get to the topics at hand. We have many. First of all, today is the day that the Trump trial is expected to go to a jury. And we don't know the exact timing on this as of yet. What we do know is that closing arguments finished yesterday. They had a marathon session, and they went into, it was a 10 hours that they went yesterday, those poor jurors, and they heard all of it. And at one point, I believe it was the lead prosecutor turned to the jury and said, are you up for just staying and keep going? And they're all like, yes, let's just get out of here. Like, yes, let's do it. You know, don't prolong this any more than we have to. Jurors heard a meticulous recounting of 5 weeks of testimony in the criminal trial of Donald Trump, in which prosecutors agreed he tried to, quote, hoodwink the American voter. The defense said there was not, quote, a shred of evidence. So the case heads to a jury, and we are not exactly sure what we have in the meantime. And what is going to be happening soon is the judge will be instructing the jury. I think we'll learn a lot from that as to what can be included, what has to be excluded, what they must decide, and the questions, and those decisions will come, and that should happen any moment when the judge instructs the jury. That may take a little while, and then presumably the deliberations will begin. The other thing I just wanted to get to real quick is that they seem the press has done this over the last several days, to pacify my dear friend Ira Fussfeld, some in the media have done where they'll do this, like the top five takeaways of the trial, or the top five takeaways from closing arguments. So in the New York Times, I'll just go over these takeaways, and then we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll hear from the group. But one refrain, one takeaway: Michael Cohen is a liar, and it may be the defense's best bet. Also, the defense portrayed the payment as a workaday transaction. We'll talk a little bit about that. We also see another takeaway being stagecraft making an impact, and that the fact that you if you do it with a little panache, you can get your your rebuttals and your points made. Also, prosecutors presented a unified tale. Mr. Steinglass, who presented the prosecution's closing argument, focused on telling a sweeping story about fraud on American voters, argued that an agreement Mr. Trump struck with the National Enquirer to buy and bury unflattering stories was a subversion of democracy perpetrated by a covert arm of the 2016 Trump campaign. So, with those takeaways and others out in the ether, we will take a break, and when we come back, we'll go to our panelists to discuss it as the jury gets ready to deliberate this trial, and we'll find out relatively soon what the verdict is. First, the news.
Oh, fire. You set me on fire. I swear you're the only one I take on this ride. I wanna drive you.
Gary Clark Jr. providing the music for the program this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we thank you very much for being with us. Right before the break, I gave a look at what is happening as far as the trial and the how the power is shifting to the jury as closing arguments finished up in the hush money, the Trump hush money trial late yesterday. And so now the judge is getting the giving the orders, and then the deliberations will begin. So let me go around the room and see what you all make of where we are right now. I think some of the things to discuss are what I mentioned earlier, some of the takeaways. Also, whether you think this is going to be quick or very painful over several days, or and then what? And even a thought on what the verdict may be. Who would like to go first? Libby Post.
I didn't raise my hand.
All Vera, the panelists.
I nominated, a motion to me. And
I
so
nominated
did Jim.
Libby.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thanks. Thank you. So I think that this will not be long and drawn out, but I also don't think it's going to be like instantaneous. I think it'll be a couple of days. And they have a weekend, right? What's today? Wednesday? Thursday? Today's Wednesday.
Wednesday.
So, you know, they'll deliberate for a couple of days, maybe over the weekend. It'll be interesting to see if they're sequestered. That I don't think has been decided yet. I didn't see that anywhere in what I read this morning. I have a feeling they probably will be, simply because Trump will do everything he can to sway the jury using the media and his lackeys, and or I should say his lackeys in the media, which is not us, but, you know, Fox, New York Post. I think I'm hopeful that they will find him guilty. I know a lot of people have said, oh, this case is not built on anything. I mean, John Faso's been here to say that. Even Mark Whitman said it, you know, oh, I read about something in somewhere in The Economist or something, and it's really not a strong case. I don't know. Everything that I've been reading makes it seem like it's a pretty strong case for falsifying business documents. Now, look, I'm a business owner. If I did something like this and got caught, I'd be held responsible, plain and simple. Why isn't this man being held responsible? None of our elected officials are above the law. And we need for people to understand that at the local, state, and federal level. And this is New York City recognizing that he misused his business funds for a payoff. They lied about it. Is Michael Cohen credible, or can you think he is, you know, not a nice guy? Trump screwed him. It's really that simple. Trump screwed Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen saw the light go off in his brain saying, God, what have I done? And is trying to make amends with himself. And so he told the truth. The truth that we all know is the truth. Because remember this. Trump, Access Hollywood, grabbing them by the genitals, I won't say the other word, and then this happened. This was done to blunt the impact of Access Hollywood so Stormy Daniels wouldn't go public in what it was like leading up to the last few weeks of the election in 2016. And so I'm hopeful that they will find him guilty. My fear, and I think it's a well-founded fear, is if they do, there will be blood in the streets in New York City and in other places as well, because his people will come out, the brown shirts, or maybe they wear orange shirts, I don't know. But you know what I mean. The fascists that agree with him want to shut down stations like WYMC.
I think it's red hats.
Red hats, okay, the red hats. You know, the people who want to shut down the media, want to shut down democracy, will come out onto the streets. It will make January 6th look like child's play.
Oh, wow. That's pretty scary.
It is scary, but New York City will be prepared for that. Yeah. This is where law enforcement, you know, comes in. But I have no doubt. And if he goes to jail, which I think there's, you know,
there's
50-50,
yeah,
who knows, you know, I think it'll be even worse. But the jurors and the judge cannot make these decisions based on what might happen in the streets because of the people who follow him. You know, we've seen what happens when mob rule rules the day. When mobs rule the day, we've seen it over history, and we can't let that happen with this.
We have Pecker also as a good. You know, I mean, what an interesting name he has.
Yes,
you know,
it really
shall
is.
We say more about that or not? But, you know, we have his evidence.
It goes with what he grabbed.
It really does.
Stop.
So, I mean, that is sort of, you know, another.
Check, please.
Another good piece of evidence.
Yes.
I think, you know, when you reflect on trials that deal with, other criminal offenses, mafia trials, they often use, you know, murderers and vicious, most disgusting people who give evidence, and they're believed under the circumstances. So a Michael Cohen isn't that hard to believe under the circumstances with the context that we know. I think Trump will likely be convicted of something.
Yes.
I think, you know, I don't know. You know, there's 34, I think, potential
counts
mm-hmm. that they have to decide on. I'm not sure they'll get him on all of them, but a few of them for sure, I think. You know, it'll be interesting to see. For me, the most interesting thing is always to hear interviews with jurists or the foreman afterwards, mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, they're not supposed to have talked to each other at all during this, but they, you know, they meet each other, they talk, they have impressions of each other, and then they're all of a sudden in this room and they're discussing all these issues. And so while they might have gotten along over a cup of coffee, maybe now they don't. You know, it's very interesting to sort of learn about the dynamics. But I do think we will see some conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly soon, I agree with you, maybe by next week, Monday, Tuesday or so. And it'll be eye-opening. I'm not sure I'm going as far as the immediate violence, but I do agree that Judge Merchan and the jurists need potential protection because they might be targeted. And
not
in
might.
That sense,
they
yeah,
will
well,
be.
I mean, I'm still hopeful that there is some sense of respect among some people for the judicial system. But I'm afraid that's, you know, some of the what we call now the red-capped MAGA crowd will go after possibly jurists and judges, as we've seen before.
Right.
So that is a bit of a fear, and they probably will need protection, and I'm hoping they're strong enough to, you know, since they agree to be serve on this jury, that they're strong enough to withstand those pressures.
Jim?
So imagine that you're meeting with a friend of yours who is a writer, and they say, you know, I've got an idea for a new book or a new screenplay, and it's going to be about this former president who's on trial. We have, you know, the adult one characters, the adult film actress Stormy Daniels. There's the fixer guy, Michael Cohen. There's the head of the tabloid, the aforementioned David Pecker. There is, you know, the Greek chorus for the former president, members of Congress, some of the members of his family, but not his wife. Then we have Robert De Niro showing up on behalf of the other side. I think I might say to that friend, you know, this all seems a bit over the top. This doesn't seem real at all.
And my big idea for the denouement is for one of his challengers to have a parasitic brainworm.
Yes.
Yes.
And he does.
And eat and eat and eat and then die.
Or become president.
There you
no.
go. I meant the worm.
Oh, the worm.
The worm died. Yes.
Because of what he's eating.
Yeah, well, that's what happened. Yeah. He went in and the worm ate and then died.
And then died because he wasn't vaccinated.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
This really, it what an absolute circus, and what a just kind of a manifestation of the preposterousness and the vulgarity of our time. I mean, aside from the details of this case and all of that, I mean, I do think one thing about the case that's important to keep in mind, as I understand it, it's not just about the falsifying business records, but the key thing to convince the jury of is that it's falsifying the business records in order to influence the outcome of the election, and that's an important piece, and that might be the thing that is the toughest thing to prove.
So I thought you were setting us up for a Shakespearean play or something like that when you went through all the characters. I'm like, I wonder which play he's going to...
Yeah.
No, this is more...
I think this is... Yeah.
It's more Benny Hill.
Exactly.
Benny Hill?
Aspires to be Benny Hill.
Hill. Oh,
yeah.
My God. I try to erase that name from my brain.
No, really. I mean, it does remind me a bit of, you know, Bonfire of the Vanities, Tom Wolfe, New York in the 80s. Yeah. But this is...
Well, remember, Trump came up during that time.
Well, you always bring up Roy Cohn. I mean, this is what we're coming out of.
Right, and he and Trump keeps wanting his lawyers to channel their inner Roy Cohn, and he's upset with them when they don't.
We will continue in just a moment. We have letters, and we will get to those in just a moment. We welcome you to join in on the fun. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning we are talking about the Trump hush money trial, which is now expected to go to the jury probably mid to later today if all things go as planned, and as we've learned throughout this trial, sometimes things do not go as planned, but the jury is expected to get instructions, and then the deliberations will take part, and then the question marks begin to fill in as to what will happen next. We have letters, and we welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Bella writes, I'm afraid there will be a hung jury, which Trump will spin as being completely innocent. This will propel him into the White House unless things change. Israel ends the war. And the news gets better for Joe Biden. Well, that hung jury certainly is a possibility.
It is. And
I think someone on the panel yesterday brought this up, which I also think is a good point, that no matter what happens, Trump is going to try to spin this as to being completely innocent. So right. I don't know.
I mean, you know, the innocence part he insists on. Either it's a completely rigged jury or the entire legal system is a joke in this country or whatever he says, it's always in his favor. Yeah. You know, that's just what he does.
I don't know that it's going to make a I mean, it's hard to say that it could be found guilty and yet still we're on some of the charges. But I think even if it's not all of the charges and goes completely through, there's going to be a lot of a lot thrown at us as far as the reasoning for that.
He's going to deny it all and say it's rigged. I mean, just like the election was rigged, the jury was rigged, the case was rigged. I did nothing wrong.
All of New York is rigged,
right? You know, he just refuses to take responsibility for anything he's done, and he always accuses someone else of the crimes that he's already committed and the actions that he's already done.
But it doesn't seem that he's paying any political price up to this point, at least.
No.
Yeah.
No.
It's amazing.
Even the time, I mean, I remember on this panel several months ago, maybe even a year ago, talking about how if these trials lined up the way that we thought they may line up, that he would spend most of the campaign season in a courtroom. Well, he certainly spent a portion of the early part and certainly the primary season in a courtroom. But has that proven to be detrimental? Not yet.
Maybe quite the opposite.
Right, because
he's getting more play.
Well, and it's bringing in a lot of money.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing.
He doesn't get to say all of the crazy things he usually says.
But it's amazing how stupid people are that they're giving him money, that they respond to this.
It's actually very sad. I think it's just, you know, you give money thinking for one thing and it might be used for something entirely different. And I think people are just being hoodwinked all the time.
Chris says, I agree with Libby. I agree about Michael Cohen. Everything bad about him when he worked for Trump were the very reasons Trump employed him. The defense calling him a liar is amazing since the defendant is the biggest liar in history. Then we go to Brad. Even if Mr. Trump is found guilty and the judge sentences him to prison time, it is a virtual guarantee that he will not serve a day behind bars. He will reach into his playbook for his trusty delay. Mm-hmm.
Appeal.
Mm-hmm. Appeal the verdict, and it will take many months or even longer for the next trial and appeal to resolve. And then, even then, he wouldn't face any jail time. Perhaps mention that he does have the right to an appeal. Well, of course, yes, he will have a right to appeal, and he will appeal probably the minute the it'll happen quickly, and which is his right. So yes, expect nothing other than that. Betty writes, I love your panel discussions. There are many charges, 32, for the jury to consider. I think they'll take a few days so we all see that they considered all of them. I hope for guilty on most, if not all. I think the former president is the worst man to be in politics in my lifetime. And that is from Betty. Then we go to Peg. Just please keep in mind that Trump claims that even if guilty, there is no crime. Well, right. That's what we were just
saying. Of claim to innocence. And, you know, he was not aware of how money was used. Right. We don't see that in he has a track record, obviously, in terms of knowing exactly what the money is used under what circumstances all the time.
I don't know. I just wanted to go to one. Michael Cohen is a great example of the kind of lawyers that Trump hires, says Adam. I'm surprised Cohen didn't say to the defense, come on, knock it off. You're the new me. Speaking of dissemblers, Stefanik is not so much trying to win Jewish voters with the gulag against anti-Semitism in colleges and city schools. Jews have seen Christian majorities go after education and thought before.
No, the Republicans are normalizing a dumbed-down anti-Semitic version of anti-Semitism. It's red meat for the base. That is not where I thought that particular letter was going to go in regards to Elise Stefanik, but Elise Stefanik has been instrumental in this case in filing several judicial complaints against the judge and against against the court.
Yeah.
So that is something to keep in mind as well.
I think it's also important to keep in mind why she's doing that. One, it seems to me, is that it works well for her politically. Mm-hmm. Pays no price in her district. Probably quite the opposite. Secondly, probably bolsters her case to be a VP candidate.
Yeah.
I mean, what? I think it has very little to do with the merits of these complaints.
This is Representative Stefanik slaps Judge Juan Marchand with misconduct complaint over "quote unquote" random assignment to the Trump hush money trial, and I believe this is, and I could be wrong on this, and I apologize, I don't have it right in front of me. I believe this is the third of these that she has filed, but in the latest, it says Acting Justice Marchand presided over the criminal trial against the Trump Organization and will be presiding over the criminal trial of Steve Bannon, a senior advisor in President Trump's White House and a prominent advocate of President Trump. Stefanik continued, noting that there will be at least 24 sitting justices eligible to oversee the cases, but Marchand, an acting justice, was selected for all three related to the presumptive 2024 GOP nominee for president and his allies. So there is that. The House Republican The House Republican Conference Chairwoman's complaint with the Inspector General of the New York State Unified Court System called for an investigation into Judge Marchand's determining whether the required random selection process was in fact followed. So to say that that was not a random case of him overseeing these trials, that it was more, what's the word? Sinister?
The fix was in.
Yeah.
Sinister, I think, yes.
I don't think so.
All right. So let's go. We have just about a minute and a half before we go to break, and we have one or two letters that we can use. If Trump is found guilty, President Biden can withdraw Trump's Secret Service.
Ooh.
That from Rodney.
I don't think that's true.
I don't know that that's true, and I don't see why you would do that.
But if he goes to jail, does he get Secret Service?
He gets
in
a
the
special
lockup?
Jail.
Oh, he gets a special jail.
I think he gets like an ankle monitor. That's a special jail.
Oh, so he won't go to the lockup?
No.
Not even the minimum security federal club fed?
I mean, my guess is no.
But it's my understanding that the Secret Service is with him.
Yes.
No matter what.
Yeah, life term, right? Once as a former
president,
life term.
It certainly is a life term and terminal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hypothetically, should Trump be found guilty, could judge remand him into custody immediately while the conviction is appealed? Also, could the contempt charges ready in a couple of days in the lockup? I mean, I don't know. As far as the first part of the question about while the conviction is appealed, I mean, hypothetically, I guess, yes, but these are, I mean, we can't, however we may feel, these are not major charges.
No.
Yeah, he's not, I mean, honestly, I don't think he's going to jail, and if he, you know, he will appeal immediately, and then he's not going to any detention while on appeal. I mean, this is all, you know, wishful thinking for those that have, you know, particular desires.
And Diane says, I agree. What is very sad is that people are sending money to Trump, what is even sadder is that these very people who don't have the money to send to begin with and who would rather go into further debt than to put food on their table for their children. That from Diane.
Yeah. I mean, this is sad. Yeah.
All right. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to a new topic, and we'll talk about other stuff. We have Jim Ketterer, Vera Carias-Kelly, and Libby Post on the panel this morning. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. You can also spend a moment or two and help fill the lockbox, WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and do all of that as you listen to the dulcet tones of Ray Graff with news.
One thing I can tell you is you got to be free. Come together.
The last thing I want to do is talk over that. My God.
Yeah.
What the hell? Let's just all go out, take a walk, and let him finish up that song. That's amazing. Gary Clark Jr. playing the Palace in Albany, New York on Saturday. You can find out more at palacealbany.org. Well, that'll wake you up. Good stuff from Gary Clark Jr. All right, let's get to a new topic, and it will not be as boisterous as what we just heard, but we will try to, yeah, we can try, right?
Yeah.
What the, what do we got to lose here?
You don't want to hear us singing, though.
You know, I have to say, no, I don't. You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
No, you don't.
I have to say that Jim mentioned this earlier, and I didn't pick up on it because I was going to hold it as another topic. But when Jim was talking about this, you wouldn't believe any of this being in the novel. But in a story I call. And then De Niro showed up.
is the
idea that the Biden campaign edges in on the Trump trial media frenzy, and this is a sanctioned campaign event, right? This comes from the Biden campaign, I believe. And what they decided to do is to go to the courthouse, very near the courthouse, and to have an event with Robert De Niro. Friends call him Bob. And it is actually an engagement in the criminal trial by staging a news conference on the courthouse's doorstep, injecting the president's core campaign themes into the coverage, but feeding claims from Trump's team that the prosecution is political. Eric was out on the same steps of the courthouse last night saying this is an example of what a witch hunt this is, that they all put this together, they dreamed this up, and that is why, and you can see this because this event took place there. I don't follow that logic exactly, but okay.
Can I just ask Libby?
Yeah.
So you're running the Biden campaign. I come to you and I say, Libby, I've got this idea. Why don't we get Bobby De Niro to show up at the courthouse and we're going to script an extensive rant for him to deliver. And I think this is a great idea. What do you think?
I think it's I think it wasn't a stupid idea. I think it was miscalculated because I think Trump will be able to use it against them. And it puts Biden in the same level in the gutter, and it's so to speak, as Trump. I think it was not the right decision to make. If Bobby De Niro went down there on his own, that's one thing. But if he went down there, Bobby De Niro, Al Pacino, you know, we get all the guys to go down on their own and speak out. That's one thing, but. To say that there's a direct link with the Biden campaign, I think, was a miscalculation.
I like your answer, though. You could say, well, De Niro, maybe not. But if you can get Al Pacino, too, we're on.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, but if they did it on their own. But they would have to be the ones.
Right. To have it be a campaign event.
Right. To have it be a campaign thing is not, I don't think, was the best. Now, believe me, I'm all for political theater, but it's. Political theater that works well.
But remember how the left went nuts when the in 2016 when there was the debate between Hillary Rodham Clinton and Donald Trump, and Jennifer Flowers was invited to sit in the front row by the Trump campaign.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's political theater, and it's that's not helping anybody. But
it helped Trump.
No, I know. I meant, yeah, you knew what I meant.
Yeah. Well, it's not. I mean, you know, it hurt Hillary. It hurt Hillary because she has to look at this woman.
Right, and it's obviously
and
done. They knew exactly what they were doing. This is right after the Access Hollywood and so forth.
Right, Steve Bannon and the other guy. And
So my question is, and I think Jim's question to you is a really good one. But if you also have De Niro, who is and I say this lovingly, but is sort of wacky when he starts talking about Trump. I mean, he's off the.
He went a little unhinged,
right.
And it doesn't look good for anybody. And the media will just pick up the unhinged and not the substance, especially the New York City media. So that's it.
And particularly in the context of all the other aspects of the circus that are already underway.
Right. Right.
The Michael Tyler, who is the Biden campaign's communication director, and this may be the lamest excuse that I've heard in a while, but here we go, said they held the event at the courthouse for access to the blocks-long row of TV cameras breaking into live coverage. He said, "We're here because you're here."
Well, I mean, I think what he was trying to say is we are going to engage in the same kind of, you know, drama, media, attention-seeking behavior as you are, and we can do it too.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I don't know. I think maybe there's some people that are listening to De Niro, and they say, you know, finally, we're also doing something like Trump, what Trump does daily, and we can push back and sort of create some excitement around the idea of just being a regular guy who just talks about these things that are worrying him, and he's, you know, appealing to a certain crowd in New York City.
Meanwhile, the judge in the trial, Juan Merchan, has started to deliver instructions to the Trump jury and has said, "You are the judges of the facts, and you are responsible for deciding whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty." So that is underway as we speak about what else was going on yesterday at the courtroom in Manhattan.
Joe, can I just say one thing about that? Having been on a jury last summer, I just imagine the challenge being on this jury to cut through all of the circus that we're talking about, to cut through all the circus outside of the courtroom, but also in the courtroom, and to really follow the law as instructed by the judge and by the judge alone. That really is going to be quite a challenge for these people.
The judge has also told the jury that do not think that anything he said during the trial indicates that he has an opinion on the trial, which is interesting because of some of the things that he said. Obviously, he has reacted negatively to some of the more brash attacks by the Trump team. So, as Robert De Niro is outside of the courtroom, the Biden folks have finally done it, said Trump campaign spokesman Jason Miller. After months of saying politics had nothing to do with this trial, they showed up and made it a campaign event. Why the change? Because Joe Biden's numbers are in the tank. Well, that may not be inaccurate.
Yeah. I mean, the polls are all within the margin of error. Some of the margins of error are like 7% now. And so, you know, it's a lot of prognostication. It's May. The election is in November. You know, let's see what the polls are saying once we get through the summer.
Well, and that wasn't an indictment of the polls, but what I was getting at is if Biden was up by 7, would he be sending Robert De Niro to the courthouse
Probably
steps?
Probably not.
Right. Okay.
The Biden campaign brought De Niro, who recently provided the voiceover for a Biden television ad, and the two officers who helped defend the U.S. Capitol from rioting Trump supporters on January 6th. The focus on Trump's tolerance and inspiration of political violence reflects one of three themes that the Biden campaign is driving leading up to the first debate on June 27th in Atlanta, the others being abortion and economic policies. De Niro spoke over profane taunts and chants from Trump supporters.
What is
Bobby
surprise.
De Niro?
Like,
yeah. demonstrating in the neighborhood park, calling them crazy and a sign of the chaos that Trump sows. Former Washington police officer Michael Finone, who was violently assaulted on January 6th, said Trump would govern as an authoritarian who answers to and serves only himself. Harry Dunn, a former Capitol police officer who ran unsuccessfully in a Democratic congressional primary in Maryland, said Trump is continuing to encourage political violence, noting that his supporters were heckling him and Fanon as traitors, as they did on January 6th. All right, let's go to other topics as we move away from the trial, and we'll bring you up to date on anything that happens there over the next several hours, days, as the jury takes this into consideration. So now let's go to what is more election stuff having to do with the state of Ohio. Democratic Party leaders said Tuesday they would nominate President Biden for a second term in office via a virtual roll call of delegates to the party's national convention, bypassing a glitch in Ohio law that had threatened to keep Mr. Biden off the November ballot in the state. Ohio law requires all candidates to be legally certified by August 7th, but Mr. Biden was not scheduled to be officially nominated until after the Democratic National Convention begins on August 19th. The virtual roll call will be completed before the Ohio deadline. The party acted as the Ohio legislature was meeting in special session for the first time in two decades in an effort to pass legislation that would have resolved the ballot problem at the state level. The legislators had easily dealt with identical issues involving presidential candidates in 2012 and 2016, but deep divisions among Republicans had stalled any action for weeks. A frustrated Governor Mike DeWine, also a Republican, had summoned the legislators to the special session last week, calling their inability to end the legislative gridlock ridiculous and absurd. Only last week, the Speaker of the Ohio House, Representative Jason Stevens, was blunt about his inability to enact a quick fix for Mr. Biden's ballot problem. "There's just not the will to do that from the legislature," he told reporters on Wednesday. "It's a hyper-political environment at this time of year, and there are some Republicans who just didn't want to vote on it." The chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Jamie Harrison, issued a statement on Tuesday denouncing the Republican lawmakers for their inaction. "Joe Biden will be on the ballot in Ohio and all 50 states, and Ohio Republicans agree. But when the time has come for action, they have failed to act every time, so Democrats will land this plane on their own." I'm not sure I 100% understand the mechanism that the party is using that overrides the state legislature.
The legislature's state law in Ohio says they have to be nominated by their party by a certain date.
Right.
The legislature, the Republicans are at war with themselves in Ohio, and they couldn't do the right thing and pass a bill, because what, they only passed 14 or 17 bills the entire session, including making Warren G. Harding Day or something like that. So so they did not pass a law, which they have done in the past, to change that date to accommodate the dates of conventions. So in 2020, the Democratic Party did a virtual roll call to nominate Biden because of COVID. And so they're just doing the same thing, making the decision before the deadline so Biden will be on the Ohio ballot. I mean, does that explain things, Joe?
It does. I just wonder why they wouldn't have done that in the first place instead of waiting on the legislature and even allowing it to be a problem.
Because it's about
the process. Right.
It's a process. Right. It's the original process, but it also gives the Biden campaign the opportunity to say, look how disorganized and disruptive and disassociated they are from reality, and they can't even agree amongst themselves.
Give them enough rope to hang themselves.
Yeah. Right. Well, but also it is a way to show that members of the Republican Party, a faction of them, do not want to even allow Biden to be a candidate in Ohio.
Right, right.
This is so, it's slimy.
Outrageous.
It's anti-democratic. I mean, you allow the opposing candidate of your party to run for election in this country. And apparently in Ohio, they were trying to keep him off the ballot if possible. Well, they knew it wasn't going to be possible, but they tried, at least this group. And it's just so, you know, it's an effort to weaken
democracy
in this country. It's just in the state of Ohio. It's like, you know, you can find it on the federal level, but you can certainly also find it in state, on the state level and in local elections. And this is one of those sort of, I would consider it a slimy effort to weaken democratic standards in this country.
Not the party, but democracy.
Democracy, right.
I think it's also a preview of what we're going to be seeing over the next several months and what we're going to be seeing for several months following Election Day in November. It's important to remember that a presidential election is not one unified federal election. It is 50 parallel state elections, as well as District of Columbia and some of the territories that are happening at the same time that ultimately funnel into, let's hope, a decision as to who is going to be president. But that the states and the localities have so much to say about how these elections are administered and how results are decided and how those results are transmitted to Washington. And the lessons from 2020 were learned by both sides. And on the GOP side, they have spent a lot of time putting people in place in some of these decision-making positions on the state level, on the local level, even to make sure that there are people in polling stations, working at polling stations, there as observers. There is an entire effort that is underway to make sure that from their perspective that they don't make the same kind of mistakes that they made the last time, that there aren't Republicans in positions that they can't count on like we saw in the state of Georgia. Mm-hmm. So what we see in Ohio is just one blip, and we're going to see a lot more of it played out across the states. And it's another reason that, you know, elections to state legislatures is so important. We see, you know, relatively small amounts of attention paid to a lot of the races. And we see a lot of races for state legislatures, including in this state, where people are running unopposed or de facto unopposed, with no real opposition candidate. And that's bad for democracy, too. And it's also going to be bad in the run-up to the presidential election.
One of the things that I also was trying to figure out was the DNC figured out this workaround, but meanwhile, the Ohio legislature was still meeting in special session yesterday. They did ultimately pass a bill that would both allow Biden to appear on their general election ballot in November, but also bar foreign contributions to ballot issue campaigns. The latter was a direct response to GOP objections to the Issue One campaign last year that constitutionally protected abortion in the state. The move came without Democratic support, however, with members seemingly empowered to vote against the legislation following the DNC announcement. We don't need your fix. The DNC just released a statement several minutes ago that says we're going to hold a virtual vote of our delegates across the country and nominate President Biden to the ballot, said State Senator Bill DeMora.
we don't want a legislative fix that holds the voters and their rights to the whim of the majority.
The whim of the majority.
Yes, yeah, okay.
Isn't it usually the whim of the minority?
Yes.
Like the tyranny of the minority, right?
It's amazing, right?
I don't know if I have to say this, but I'll just say it anyway. It's brilliant political commentary, which is it seems that getting the Democratic nominee on the ballot in a state may be more than a whim.
Perhaps.
And it seems like the Republican governor of the state agrees with that.
And, Mike DeWine is not a Trumper.
No. He's actually a
Rockefeller
Republican governor of Ohio. And, you know, I mean, it gives you an indicator when people like him would say, this is a very strange concept here. But, you know, these kinds of publications about the whim of the majority, you know, if you don't pay close attention, you might actually find this appealing as just somebody who listens in casually to politics and says, yes, of course, my voice also matters, you know, and you sort of reverse ideas about who might actually want to have, you know, a right in this election. You know, I mean, the majority should determine the outcome of the election and not the minority, as far as I can tell.
Republican Governor Mike DeWine still urges a legislative remedy to the ballot amid ballot access concerns. Quote, while I understand the Democratic National Committee has just today proposed a workaround to help get President Biden on the Ohio ballot, it is prudent legislation to be passed to get this done. As I previously said, we do not want to leave something so basic as having the sitting president of the United States on the ballot to others when this can and should be done legislatively. It's the right thing to do.
Uh-huh. There you go.
Except for a majority of the Republicans in the state legislature believe that it should not be the case.
Because they're doing Trump's bidding. They're not being good representatives. They're not upholding democracy. They're following the leader.
We'll take go ahead.
I think that they're probably also responding to the constituents in their districts who are...
I'm not so sure about that.
I was going to say, what does that tell us about Ohio?
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. I think that this really is just let's screw Biden any way we can.
And I don't know Ohio well enough to know.
And you know, I don't think the constituents are saying, let's do this and tear down our democracy. Some, maybe. But I think most people are like, we need to have an election. This is how you do it.
I mean, you should have two candidates for president on the ballot there.
Right.
Yeah.
I do think that DeWine's line about we don't want to leave something so basic as having the sitting president of the United States on the ballot when we can do this legislatively seems pretty simple, doesn't it? We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up with this wonderful group, and we welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org
Requires devotion from those who truly believe.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Libby Post, Jim Ketterer, and Vera Akarius-Kelly with us. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org. We have about 15 minutes together with each other before the end of our panel segment, and we would like to go to a few more stories if we have time. Certainly we have time for this one, which is from the New York Times. Harvard, as in the Harvard University, says it will no longer take positions on matters outside of the university. The policy could ease pressure on the school to issue statements on current events. Officials were criticized for their handling of the October 7th Hamas attacks. Harvard said on Tuesday that it would now avoid taking positions on matters that are, quote, not relevant to the core function of the university. This is an acceptance of the recommendations of a faculty committee that urged the university to dramatically reduce its messages on issues of the day. if put into practice, Harvard would no longer issue official statements of empathy, which it did for Ukraine after the Russian invasion and for the victims of the October 7th Hamas attacks in Israel, for example. In issuing official statements of empathy, the university runs the risk of appearing to care more about some places and events than others, the report said. And because few, if any, world events can be entirely isolated from conflicting viewpoints, issuing official empathy statements runs the risk of alienating some members of the community by expressing implicit solidarity with others. So for God's sakes, no empathy.
Yes, right. That's just how I feel about
please
that, too.
Don't,
no empathy.
No empathy.
Let's not express any support for suffering human humans anywhere on human rights issues or anything along
we
those
got
lines.
Our own yeah. problems.
Yes.
Screw them. No empathy. Jim, you may have a more nuanced idea on this.
I don't know if it's more nuanced, but so, you know, I do think that universities had gotten themselves into a difficult situation when they got into the business of issuing statements on current events. And in that article that you're citing, Joe, Noah Feldman from Harvard Law School says, you know, universities are not governments. A university school or department is not the State Department. They don't need to take a position on these kinds of events. And so I agree with that. I think that's just on the face of it. It's true. But my colleague at Barr, Jonathan Becker, is just out with an article. The timing is excellent with regard to Harvard's decision. Jonathan's article came out just recently, and the title of it is Deeds, Not Words. And he's saying, okay, yes, we don't need to issue statements. It's counterproductive. But that doesn't mean that these institutions that are so important to not only our society, but American higher education, so important to the world, should be neutral. In fact, with their actions, with their resources, with the prestige and credibility of these institutions, they can take action. They can put things in place that are not neutral, that in fact do seek to address some of the key issues of our day, and that this is fitting and appropriate for an institution of higher education to do, and for higher education writ large to do. And so if we're talking about prison education, students' rights to vote, the welcoming of refugees and immigrants into our institutions, access to higher education, irrespective of financial resources. These are all the kinds of things that universities can and should do, and in many cases, including at Bard College, they are doing. And that's not neutrality. That is taking a position, but making it real and not just making a statement. So I urge the listeners to go find that article by Jonathan Becker. It's really very, very good. And I think it's the piece of this story that Harvard was not addressing.
Becker argues that while institutions cannot and should not, quote, issue proclamations on every social and political issue of the day, Bard College models a counter-tradition of institutional engagement, quote, rooted in liberal education and civic learning that other colleges and universities could follow. Quote, by embracing their role as civic actors, colleges and universities can place more emphasis on their deeds than on their words, allowing their civic work to represent their priorities and their commitment to important local, national, and global challenges.
And this isn't separate from the educational mission. Mm-hmm. This is at the core of that educational mission.
I would agree with that because, you know, educational institutions, especially of higher learning, have core values that they're based on, foundational values. At Siena College, we clearly have a Franciscan position on human rights and social justice and environmental protections. And those kinds of statements that are released by the leadership or faculty committees or collaborative statements by faculty and students represent those values. Not everything is released as a public statement like the State Department for the general audience. We also communicate back to our own students and to our own communities and to, you know, in our case as a Franciscan institution, we stand for particular values at Siena College. And we implement them through the ECAR, Every Campus a Refuge program that we have, where we hosted, you know, for 18 months, an Afghan refugee family with children. And we have environmental agendas that we pronounce. And we have, for example, UN Secretary General Guterres coming and speaking to us in the fall. And we have a major conference coming around, you know, on our campus. And we communicate that out. We represent values. We represent positions. And I find it rather sad that an institution with so much money as Harvard shies away because of public criticism. What they have to do is communicate basic values. What do we stand for as an institution? What do we educate our students in? What is our mission as an institution? Now, we don't have to release statements on every political event, but we have to stand for specific values. And if we shy away from supporting people that are being bombed in Ukraine, then what do we mean by that? If we shy away from doing fundraisers or speaking up for children that in Palestine or in Gaza need medical support, what are we shying away from? When are we not calling on hostages to be released by Hamas? What do we shy away from? We shy away from fundamental positions that every human life counts, whether entangled in warfare, suffering from ecological deprivation, poverty, and, you know, if we don't make statements on that, who are we? And are we true leaders in community?
Libby?
Well, I think Harvard's response was a response to the weaponization of higher ed by Elise Stefanik. And I think, you know, it put a chilling effect on a lot of those higher level or, you know, Ivy League, whatever you want to call them, schools, especially the ones where their women presidents ended up losing their jobs. And you have Elise Stefanik, a woman, supposedly, you know, championing anti-Semitism when she, championing fighting against anti-Semitism when she's never said a word about it ever until now because it's politically expedient. And so what happens is, you know, they talk about weaponizing government. Stefanik and the Republicans have weaponized higher education against the very institutions that are supposed to uphold the values of higher education. And it's about fear. It really is about fear.
What do you think? This is still up in the air for Harvard, right? I mean, they have to adopt this.
I guess so, but I mean, I think it's not just Harvard. I mean, I think this is kind of a realization that American higher education is coming to.
We all have
with
to
regard
sit down
to,
and talk, don't we?
Yeah, right. But statements in and of themselves on political positions can be counterproductive. I mean, I think that what Vera is saying about values, and I think that's largely in agreement with what Jonathan Becker has written about, but doing it through action rather than just saying we will now issue a proclamation on this or the other thing. And you know, it was easy when it was on topics where there was no pushback.
Yeah.
It's only when it received pushback then people said, well, wait a second, what are we doing here? That now we need to be neutral. Well, what does it mean to be neutral? So to not issue the statement is only part of that. If you're going to be neutral as an institution overall, is that really the right position for these institutions? And Vera, I think what you're saying
education is not neutral, right? We know education is not neutral. Education, you have to take a stand. I mean, you know, neutrality for a lot of people led to, you know, a person like Hitler
to
rise to the top, because people said, well, you know, the communists are, you know, in the streets, and we don't really want to be involved. And, you know, and then the brown shirts all came out and took over, you know. And we have to stand for something as faculty, as educational institution. We have to stand for justice. We have to stand for positions of authenticity.
So without a statement or with a statement of without a statement of empathy, let's say, then it's still going to go to the professors who opine and have opinions within their classrooms. It is still going to allow students to look at the behavior of the college and university that they're attending, what they're investing in, what they're not investing in, where their roots go. This will not solve those key problems.
We have continuing problems. I mean, I will teach a class, as I mentioned before, on, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, debacle, war, you know, longstanding issues. Am I supposed to be neutral in terms of, you know, what happened to Jewish people and what happened to Arab people? And Christians in the area? Am I supposed to be neutral? I think I have to lay out all the wrongs and all the suffering and put the puzzle together in some way, right?
Yes. But the other part of this is, if institutions like Harvard and Princeton and Yale and SUNY Albany and whatever, Siena, Bard, don't speak up, the only voices you're going to hear are Liberty University.
Yeah, well, scary thought.
But it's not just speaking up. I mean, it's one thing to speak up and say, you could release a statement and say, well, I'm against how the Taliban is behaving in Afghanistan.
Right.
It's quite another thing to say, let's give 100 Afghan students scholarships and bring them here. Let's do something that actually has a real result, and let's let that model that behavior to the students.
But that's not what they're saying.
That is not what Harvard is saying.
Exactly. Exactly. So I'm saying that you can be neutral in saying you're not going to release a statement, but if you're just neutral overall, then you're missing an opportunity to actually address the issue as it needs to be addressed.
This is Jim's alternative plan.
So, yes.
Well, I get
Becker's.
But we cannot deny the fact that if liberal centers of higher education are silent, the only voices that will be heard, and this is Trump's
plan.
This is Trump's
plan. Yeah.
The only voices that will be heard are right-wing voices.
Yeah.
Liberty University. I get this mail from this other organization. They call themselves a university all the time. That right-wing stuff. There's plenty of right-wing institutions of higher ed, and they're be the only ones that we'll hear from. Mm-hmm. And that will then make it seem like that's what higher education is about in this country.
I can understand public universities. Yes,
morning.
I can understand public universities being nervous because the legislatures give them money. That is, you know, I understand that. But Harvard and
less
Yale,
and less.
I mean, you know, Harvard and Yale and places like that, they have deep pockets. They're private. And why are they not standing up for their values? Now, they need to do more. They need to do more action. They need to do more speaking up. And they cannot be intimidated by somebody like Stefanik. I mean, that was really the caving of major private institutions.
And she may very well take a position and say, I will no longer side with any one idea, and
I think she's already done that.
Yes,
I'm saying that she will no longer take positions on matters outside of Congress.
Yeah, right. And I have a bridge I'd like to sell you.
My thanks to all of you. You're wonderful. I appreciate you being here as always. We'll be back right after this.